From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. First up on the show today, the Detroit City Council faced angry residents last night who were overcharged in property taxes. We'll find out what they had to say to their elected officials. Later on, we'll talk about how the Democratic candidates for president stack up when it comes to addressing the concerns of black voters.
Most white voters are going to vote for Trump, so the only way to defeat them is with an energized and passionate base. And the base of the Democratic Party is black voters.
And hope you're ready for some big wigs and eggs over medium. It's drag brunch in Grand Rapids.
It's wacky. It's fun. You don't really ever know what to expect. It's different every time. So it's definitely something that you just have to experience at least once if you haven't already.
Those conversations and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Were you up late last night watching those Super Tuesday primary results come in? Well, you know we were. Today we're going to talk about this candidate's left standing and how they're doing with African-American voters ahead of Michigan's all-important primary next Tuesday. But first, a little more timely news from today. Governor Whitmer asked for an expedited ruling, and she certainly got one. A federal judge has invalidated Michigan's Medicaid work requirements just a couple weeks after a related decision to strike down similar rules elsewhere. This is a blow to the Trump administration's efforts to remake Medicaid. Nicholas Bagley is a professor of health law and administrative law at the University of Michigan Law School. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Let's briefly go over the structure of what we're talking about with Medicaid work rules. Medicaid, of course, is the program that provides health care for people who are very poor and who can't work because of health problems in some cases. The Trump administration permitted waivers for states that wanted to attach work requirements to those benefits, meaning that people would have to do volunteer hours, take some job training, or be actively looking for work to qualify. And all of this passed Michigan's government under the leadership of Rick Snyder. What was the intent of the rules?
Well, it depends who you ask. The work requirements rules are nominally supposed to get people to work. If you're getting Medicaid on the government's dime, the idea is that you should be holding down a job if that's at all possible for you. But the fact of the matter is we've got pretty good research on this to suggest that work requirements in Medicaid and other programs don't actually get people get them into the workforce, that in fact these kind of work requirements serve only to cull the Medicaid rolls. And so what we've seen in other states that have rolled these out is that tens of thousands of people lose their Medicaid coverage. And I think there are a lot of people who wonder if that's really the point.
There was a pretty key ruling on a similar case a couple of weeks ago. The waivers that the Trump administration is offering to states to make these possible were also tested in Arkansas. Can you explain what another federal court panel had to say about Arkansas's rules?
Yeah, so the way this is playing out is that there are now 20 states that have asked to impose work requirements, and some of the early moving states have had their work requirements tested a little bit more quickly. Arkansas's work requirements waiver was struck down by a district court judge and then appealed to the appeals court that sits right below the Supreme Court. And that appeals court said unanimously, even with a judge on the opinion written by a Reagan appointee, said unanimously that these work requirements were unlawful. And the reasoning that the court used in that case, which involved Arkansas, applies directly to the Michigan work requirements. It was the same language approved in the same kind of waiver by the Trump administration. So what happened today is the district court that was hearing a related case involving Michigan's work requirements was that the judge just entered a short little order saying, hey, you know what? This is exactly the same program, exactly the same rationale, and for the same reason, I'm also going to put a stop to it.
Would you expect one or both of these cases to be appealed?
I think it's quite likely, although we haven't seen for sure whether or not the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level is going to take this up to the Supreme Court. They're the ones who lost the Arkansas case. They're the ones who could ask the Supreme Court to intervene. They're also the ones who are the defendants in the Michigan case. They could take an appeal to the same D.C. circuit. But that circuit's going to give us the same answer, at least until the Supreme Court intervenes.
Now, Michigan, up until this point in the year, was going forward with the understanding that the work rules were going to be a thing. And we spoke with someone at the state earlier this year who explained that MDHHS was actively trying to get people to start reporting activities. Do we know anything about how that's been going?
It's been going poorly. We now have some evidence to suggest that about one in three people who are exposed to the work requirements didn't actually report any hours in the first reporting period. And the reason for that isn't that people aren't working. Most Medicaid beneficiaries do work, and if they aren't working, they usually have a reason that would exempt them from the work requirements. The trouble is, if you think about it, these work requirements force you to go and fill out your hours on a computer system you're unfamiliar with in connection with a program you may not even know you're on. And these work requirements are basically unknown to a big chunk of the population. They're caught completely by surprise. They don't fill out the paperwork. And as a result, they lose their health insurance.
A spokeswoman for Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey told the Detroit Free Press that the court ruling today focused on the federal government's approval of the work requirements, meaning to say that the court didn't say anything specific about the substance of Michigan's laws and work rules. Is there any way for Michigan to go forward with this law as written without the federal waiver?
No, absolutely not, right? The state of Michigan can only impose work requirements if the federal government has given it permission to do so. And the court action today said that the permission that we'd previously received, well, that was unlawful. It was arbitrary. You couldn't give that kind of permission. Since that court ruling has come down, the Michigan work requirements have got to be stopped, at least unless and until the Trump administration goes to the Supreme Court to say, hey, could you please put a pause to these lower court rulings?
This isn't the first time that work rules have come up as a possible new addition to Medicaid. But given that we've seen this play out a few times, do you think that there is a legal avenue that Michigan could explore if this was going to move forward in any way?
I think if Michigan wants to impose work requirements, the Trump administration is going to have to win its lawsuit at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court may look more favorably upon work requirements than the appeals court. We simply don't know. But that's going to take time. And one thing I want to notice is that the Supreme Court isn't going to resolve any case before about a year from now at the earliest. And we have an election between now and then. And if a Democrat were to win, whether that's Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, that Democrat is almost certain to withdraw every single waiver allowing states to impose work requirements. So this election is quite meaningful for people who are on Medicaid right now. If a Democrat wins, tens of thousands of people will retain coverage.
Nick Bagley of the University of Michigan's Law School. Nick, thanks for being here today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Last night, a packed house turned out for a public meeting in Detroit. City Council was listening to residents with an eye to making amends for a failure of tax policies that tilted thousands of homeowners into debt and many into foreclosure. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick was there and joins us now. Hey, Sarah, how you doing?
Hey, April.
Well, what would you say the mood was in the room?
Overall, the mood was pretty... I'd say it was angry, and it got a little intense and pretty emotional at times. That's pretty understandable, I guess, given what some of the folks who were speaking about this issue had been through.
Just to recap, the issue is the city of Detroit failed to use realistic estimates of residential property values for years during and after the Great Recession. When times were good, these property values were listed high compared with what some of them might have actually sold for. And as a result, people's property taxes soared, folks got behind on payments, fell into debt, and there were homes that were foreclosed as a result. The Detroit News published several investigative stories if folks want to read more. Sarah, what were the people who were coming to this hearing saying about the magnitude of the problem?
Well, a number of people who had been there had obviously read the Detroit News investigations as well as other information about this, and a number of them seemed to know the exact amount that they were overtaxed or that their relatives' homes were overtaxed, and they spoke about that. And for some of them, it ranged from about $1,000 to, in one case, $6,000 or $7,000. And people were obviously upset about that. This was what Detroiter Valerie Burris had to say about it.
$600 million of wealth of mostly Black people has been stolen and transferred into private propertiers' hands. That is the issue.
And the $600 million that Burris is referring to there is what the Detroit News pegged in their investigation as the amount of overtaxation that happened from 2010 to 2016. But the news and other some other folks suggest that that's actually a fairly conservative estimate.
Is the city in any position to just pay people back?
Well, Mayor Mike Duggan's office says no, and there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that they claim at this point that would be illegal because the legal process for formally appealing your property assessment and challenging that has already passed. They also claim that it would simply be too expensive and that if they were to fully compensate people, they'd have to do that by raising property taxes, and that could set off a whole nother cycle of this debt and tax foreclosure. So they're saying no.
What kinds of other solutions were brought up last night? Was there anything that council might realistically take on?
Well, there's a whole slew of measures that the council is actually considering in a committee right now, and that would include tax credits for people who could prove that they were overassessed and overpaid. So that would be one solution, potential solution. There are some others that have been suggested by the Duggan administration that are kind of nebulous at this point, but they include things like help with home buyback programs and just other sorts of measures that that might help folks ease this burden a little bit.
Five homeowners filed a class action lawsuit asking for a number of things, including an across-the-board cut for assessment for all properties valued $30,000 and under, or just making it easier for homeowners to figure out if the city is overcharging them. Was there any serious discussion of those as possible remedies that might happen outside of whatever happens with the suit?
I think the city actually has, under a lot of pressure and from lawsuits and other things, to be fair, has made that process significantly easier in the past few years and also made it easier for people to access the low-income property tax exemption. But a lot of folks would argue that it's kind of A, too little, too late, and B, that there's still pretty significant hurdles for folks to get access to these things. But a lot of that is still kind of a work in progress.
Sarah, thanks for talking to us about this.
No problem at all. My pleasure.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Still to come, drag brunch in Grand Rapids.
It's wacky. It's fun. You don't really ever know what to expect. It's different every time. So it's definitely something that you just have to experience at least once if you haven't already.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Since 2018, a small group of artists in Grand Rapids have been hosting a weekend meal that is so full of realness, it will blow you away.
Okay. All right. We're going to go down. Now, obviously, I don't want to have to beat anybody up, so no booing, right? If you're going to boo for anybody, it's going to be me because I'm an awful person. Okay, so what we're going to do, an old-fashioned lip-sync competition. Okay?
Coming next on a Shoot 69, ladies and gentlemen, she is our birthday girl. Give it up for Gabriella Stratton galore!
If impersonating Beyonce is your destiny child, this one is for you. It's Drag Brunch. CEO Trevor Straub and brunchette and gender illusionist Gabriella Galore are part of the Brain Trust, inviting everybody to nosh and dish on the weekends with the mightiest of queens. And they're joining us today. Welcome both of you to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Hi, April. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about how Drag Brunch got started? I don't know, Trevor, would you like to begin?
Absolutely. It started on July 1st of 2018. I went kind of regularly to the local drag shows at the nightclub here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I found myself immensely impressed by the professionalism and the talent that I was witnessing on the stage. And after experiencing a drag brunch for my birthday the previous year in Washington, D.C., I felt this sudden urgency, you know, to bring this unrecognized art form to many people, to daytime entertainment, and to just broaden the spectrum.
Gabriella, had you ever been to a brunch before you started this?
Yeah. Well, I love brunch. I love a good mimosa. So, but yes, I also have been to a lot of drag brunches before as well. I've been entertaining for about 8 years. So if I'm traveling around out of town and I see a drag brunch, I love to go and support. There's a very well-known drag brunch throughout the U.S. called Hamburger Mary's. That's a chain that they have. And they've done shows in lots of major cities. And that's where I kind of got my first taste of drag brunch. And then we also did have a, you know, kind of like an annual drag brunch here in Grand Rapids, but no one was doing it regularly in Grand Rapids. And I'm like, aren't we a major city? Why aren't we doing this?
Right. For those who have not had the pleasure yet, I mean, what is the full experience? It is not just sitting down to brunch with people. How do you describe what's happening?
Yeah, well, so drag brunch is definitely, it is like live theater, improv, comedy. It's kind of like, it's an experience is the only way I can say it. The show is very interactive. These queens have all different talents. You know, we do a lot of lip sync performances. Obviously, we're giving you, you know, gender illusion, which a lot of people, especially in the Midwest, aren't always that familiar with. And this is a way that's really easily accessible for a lot of people. So, and it's a comfortable setting too. You know, you come, you have great food, you have, you know, your best gal pals with you or your friends with you. And you get to see this show that for a lot of people, they don't get this opportunity to see it in the light of day. It's wacky. It's fun. You don't really ever know what to expect. It's different every time. So it's definitely something that you just have to experience at least once if you haven't already.
Gabriella, have the shows evolved over the past years?
Yes. So when we first started, you know, our structure has changed and we're kind of constantly adapting the show. We do different things where we have, you know, interactive games that we play with audience members and things like that. And we switch out those games just to keep people on their toes. And of course, all the brunchettes, we change our, you know, our costumes and the acts that we perform very frequently as well. So each time you go, even if you're a repeat bruncher, you can always get something new every time.
Or repeat offender, I suppose.
Yeah, repeat offender. That's a great way to put it.
Trevor, who does the food?
We partner with local venues, and it kind of gives the venues an opportunity to showcase, you know, if they're not a brunch spot, you know, it gives them a platform and an opportunity to show new people, new customers, what their kitchen is all about and what kind of food they're looking to give you. So that's actually the case for the first place we ever did a show. They were not a brunch spot and they took on this opportunity with us and took a chance on us and, you know, debuted their brunch food through this event with us. So that was also really exciting and a cool thing to see that they continuously are doing brunch now.
So when I first heard about this, the first thing I couldn't believe was that you were getting people out of bed before noon. That's just, that's an achievement.
That is true. You know, I will say our partiers, the ones who definitely like to go out late at night and catch us at the nighttime shows, they usually come to the second showing, not the first showing at 11.
Well, the second thing that knocked me out about this is that you're doing this in Grand Rapids. Not that there are not quality queens there, because clearly that is not the case, but more that there might be places in larger towns in Michigan that might appear safer. Does it feel like a safe place to be out and doing this?
Yeah. You know, I've lived in Grand Rapids since 2009, and I come from a very rural, small town up north called Bear Lake, where my graduating class was in high school was 39 people. So, you know, someplace like Grand Rapids, I'm like, in my mind personally, I'm like, oh yeah, it's way safer for something like this. I think people traditionally viewed Grand Rapids as this very conservative place, but, you know, we're kind of in this cultural shift, I feel, especially for West Michigan, where you're seeing a lot more of, you know, progressive mindsets, a lot more, you know, innovation in a lot of ways. And one of those ways, I think we just kind of struck when the iron was hot, so to speak, with brunch. You know, had we done this maybe like 7-8 years ago, you know, it might have been a little bit different. But I think that there's just an increasingly open-minded population here in West Michigan, and we just happen to hit it at the right time. And it's so amazing to see how it's taken off and to see people's minds change as we do this too.
Trevor, have you ever had to deal with any hecklers or pushback from within the community or people coming to Grand Rapids to give you a hard time?
We try to do one destination show a month. So, you know, we do two local shows here in Grand Rapids and then one out of town. So with that being said, I think it was our second time going to Holland. Mm-hmm. We did receive some criticism from the former mayor of Holland, actually. And, you know, she just was publicly speaking in not a very appropriate way. And also in Spring Lake, we had protesters outside during our performances. But I will tell you that after the first show, our audiences actually counter-protested them and showed us tremendous amounts of love outside. And, you know, that's not what we want. Like, those are not the kind of reactions that we want. So I kept telling, you know, the entertainers, I said, don't give them any pieces of mind. Don't look at them through the windows. Just, we're here to do what we do, and they can waste their time outside with incorrect sign spellings.
Well, I mean, I feel like part of the whole art is really having something to offer back to anyone who's heckling, very much like with stand-up comedy.
Right.
Gabriella, would you say that that's you have an
absolutely.
MO?
Absolutely. I will tell you, you know, like within the venue, we of course we're cracking jokes and making fun. But, you know, one thing, because we did have, you know, a couple of people from the local paper there and things like that, we wanted to of course best represent our community. And for us to do that, you know, we don't want to engage negativity, but for every one protester that we had, and there really weren't that many of protesters, but for every one protester we had, there was three counter protesters. And these were people just walking by on the street, you know, people who lived in the town, and they just saw what was happening and they felt a need to stop. So it wasn't just the audience members who were to our show that was counter protesting. It was just people who were walking on the street that were like, this is not what our community represents. So again, we just really are noticing that there is a shift, a cultural and a mental shift. And people, you know, want us in their community, and they understand what we're doing and they love what we're doing.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Gabriella Galore and Trevor Straub. They are part of the crew that originated Michigan Drag Brunch. Gabriella, would you tell us what you feel like you bring to the stage?
Oh my gosh. Well, it depends on the day, what hair I have on and how I'm feeling. But what I bring to the stage, I think, is a perspective that not a lot of people get to experience. You know, I'm somebody who's part of, you know, a minority community, and I want to share, you know, my story. So I think that's what I bring each and every time I take the microphone. You know, I tell people I'm from a small little town in Michigan. I am, you know, a rural community member. I know what it's like to be from Michigan, but I also am different in a lot of ways, and here's what's different. And I think I wow a lot of people with, you know, what I look like when I'm not in drag versus when I'm in drag. And I think that just amazes people to see that somebody who comes from, you know, a tiny town up north in Michigan come and, you know, I cross-dress on the weekends, and it's insane to think that this is my career. And I just, I hope I bring, you know, a perspective that people can see and go like, wow, this is really cool. You can be, you know, a queer person who does something that's a little outside the box and still be accepted by, you know, the greater community. So I bring myself to the stage each and every time. And of course, the glamorous hair and the costumes and sequins and rhinestones so bright that it'll blind you if you stare too long. You know, that's always, of course, what I bring too.
My personal favorite is the rainbow leotard.
Oh, thank you so much. I love that costume too. I feel very pride appropriate when I wear it.
Yes.
Drag Brunch has some ties with HQ, which is the drop-in center for young people in housing crisis.
Yes,
a great many of whom are part of the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
Why was that important?
So this was HQ was a huge important thing for us because, you know, as queens, drag queens in general are known for being activists in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, I don't think you can do drag without being an activist in some way. It just kind of is innate part of it. And HQ was a way for us to give back to not only our community, but just the community of West Michigan in general. So HQ, for those that don't know, is a local nonprofit. It's a drop-in shelter for youth struggling with unstable or unsafe housing conditions, ages 14 to 24. So it's kind of like that group where, you know, you might be living at a home, but, you know, if you come out as gay, you know, might not have a home the next day. So it's like, what do you do? Where do you go for resources? How do you continue, you know, living your life? It's very difficult. So the drop-in is for all people ages 14 to 24, but of those who have been helped, they've helped over 1,750 non-repeated youths since they've opened their doors 5 years ago. And of those, over 30% of them identify as part of the LGBT community, which if you think of it in terms of, you know, a minority community, for 30% out of that 1,750, it's absolutely outrageous to think that that many people are being told in 2020 that because of, you know, who they love or who they are, that they're not worthy of love or, you know, a home. So it was super important for us to have something to anchor as like our mission. Like, why, what are we doing this for? And that is what we are doing it for.
When you take the show on the road, do queer folk come up and talk to you about the fact that they really don't have access to this community in any other way?
I mean, absolutely. I think there's a lot of people, queer people, who come to our show and are like, you know, wow, I never thought I would, you know, be able to see this in my hometown, let alone in the light of day. But more importantly, we have people who are not part of the LGBT community come up and say, you know, wow, I've never experienced anything like this. Like, I've never heard this perspective, or I've never heard of HQ. I've never seen anyone like you. And I'm like, well, I'm glad that I get to be your first experience. And like, now that you know what's going on, and they get impassioned and they get emboldened to want to help. And that's really what we aspire to do. And that's really what makes us happy, is when we inspire people outside of the community to be like, we want to be involved too.
You never forget your first drag brunch.
Never. Oh my gosh, never.
Well, as you kind of alluded to, there are drag brunches in other places. What's really unique about Michigan Drag Brunch that maybe you wouldn't see in Chicago or DC or Atlanta?
Well, I would like to say that Michigan Drag Brunch has broke two world records for the largest drag brunches ever. The first was last year in 2019 for our St. Patrick's Day brunch. We had over 300 people at the JW Marriott. And then just this past January, we broke our own record with over 600 people at the JW Marriott as well. So I want people to know, like, this is, you know, quality entertainment for a fantastic cause. So get your butts out there. Go enjoy a Sunday fun day and, you know, give back to the community in the most fun way I know how.
Smashing. Gabriella Galore and Trevor Straub of Michigan Drag Brunch have been my guests today. Thank you both so much. And please save us a plate for the next one, would you?
You got it, girl. Let me know when you're coming.
Speaking of breakfast or brunch, this might be the sweetest season. It is maple syrup season right now.
Hello again. I'm Mrs. Butterworth.
And Jemima Pancakes without her syrup.
Just pour Log Cabin over your favorite ice cream and enjoy the treat of rich, real maple flavor.
And when you think of waffles, you can practically taste the luscious maple flavor of Johnny Fair syrup. Why not give the men folks a waffle treat tonight? And remember to invite Johnny Fair.
Oh, no, no, no. This is not the maple-flavored syrup of your childhood. This is real maple syrup. I'm pretty excited. According to the experts, this is an excellent year for syrup production in Michigan. The warmish winter days, the freezing temperatures at night. Our season begins in February in lower Michigan and extends into April for the Upper Peninsula. Michigan ranks 7th in maple syrup production in the U.S. The luscious amber sweetness is one of the few agricultural crops in which the demand actually exceeds the supply, meaning, I suppose, a lot of plates of chicken and waffles out there right now feeling extremely lonely. If you have a syrup spot you particularly like, would you please tweet us at Michigan Radio? I need your recommendations. And may stacks of fluffy pancakes and warm maple syrup be with you. Next up on Stateside, how the Democratic candidates for president stack up addressing the concerns of black voters. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Super Tuesday's election results represented a chance for a much broader swath of the American electorate to make some choices for the Democratic presidential primary. Bernie Sanders came home a winner for states like California, but Joe Biden roared back with victories in South Carolina and Virginia, states where a significant part of his party's electorate is black voters. Michigan's primary, and perhaps indeed this year's presidential contest, might turn on some of the same issues motivating African-American voters in other parts of the country. We were intrigued by a recent article by Michael Harriet published in The Root assessing the major candidates' agendas and records with respect to the issues black voters care about. Michael Harriet joins us now. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Given all the research you've done into the Democratic candidates' stances and what you know of the states that were voting yesterday, were you surprised by last night's results?
I think I was surprised, not because of the research I'd done. I think the polls and the political narratives made the results surprising because I think we expected at least a closer contest in the states in the South. And I think very few people expected such a rousing victory by Joe Biden. So I think the results were surprising to most people, but not because of the issues.
You took on this article in the interest of finding out more about not just what the conventional wisdom is about the various Democratic candidates for president, but actually how the things that they say and the things that they have done might play with respect to African-American voters' interests. I mean, let's break this down a little bit. Like you say, we're not talking about a monolithic vote here. Yeah. What kinds of things were on your mind when you first took this on with respect to differences between older voters and younger voters, urban, suburban, and rural voters, that you kind of had to keep all these different bases covered?
I wasn't necessarily looking at the candidates. I was looking at the candidates' written policy, right? So, you know, the overwhelming, as you said, the narrative around the candidates wasn't as important as what they had written and explicitly said that they would do. And I wanted to dive into that because there's always this overwhelming argument about, you know, what these candidates stand for, what they've actually said, what they've actually done. So I decided to look at their platforms and their policy to see and how that fit with the wishes of Black America in the things that they were looking for candidates.
Give us a quick rundown on the methodology for this, what you were looking at the candidates based on and who you asked to help review all this.
Okay. So what we did is we broke the first three categories, education, politics, and economics, right? We just didn't want to look at the political written policy. What we also did is, does it align with the things he's done in his past? We wanted to know, does it align with, you know, does it seem intentional? Does it, how detailed is it? How comprehensive is it, right? And most importantly, can these ideas be passed? Can they come to reality, right? So we took all of that. And I used probably about 17 Black political pundits, reporters, different policy wonks. And, you know, they helped me come up with this matrix. And we looked through we downloaded all of the candidates' campaign materials, waded through each of them. And it took a long time. It was surprisingly a lot of material to wade through. And then we graded each one on how do you feel about economics? How do you feel about what do they say about education and education disparities? What are they going to do about voter suppression and representation? And then how likely are they to get it passed? Do they have the skill to get it passed? Do they have the legislative experience to get it passed? How intentional have they been in the past about catering or showing Black issues or highlighting Black issues, or is it just performative, right? So we took all of these things, we graded them 1 through 10 on each different category, and we came up with the score.
Do you mind just summarizing for us who was at the top of the rankings?
Okay, so number one, we had Elizabeth Warren, because and the reason why Elizabeth Warren scored so high is not just because her policies were so aligned with what Black people look for in a candidate, but because they were so detailed. She didn't just say, I am going to do this thing. She said, I am going to do this thing. This is how I'm doing it. And you can even look at the draft legislation on how I propose to do it, right? So she was number one. Number two was Joe Biden. Now, Joe Biden, while many people consider him a moderate, right, one of the things that got him such a high score was that he just has years of experience, right? So he proposed ideas that were pretty moderate. They weren't groundbreaking, right? But he has he proposed specific legislation, and he even showed, hey, look, I got this done in the past. And not only that, right, he has the experience we know. Like, there might not be another presidential candidate in history with as much legislative experience in passing laws, no matter which party is in power, than Joe Biden.
This is someone who has a long record in both the House and the Senate, in addition to being vice president.
Right, right. And, you know, like, when we talk about things like health care, he was in the administration that got it done, right? When you talk about, income disparity, his was the first administration in 40 years that brought down the income disparity by taxing the wealthy and lessening taxes on the poor. So that's why he scored so high.
The third person on your list was someone who I think might surprise some people reading the article, Pete Buttigieg, who's now out of the race. And he was a candidate who actually drew a fair amount of suspicion from Black voters, at least in terms of, you know, the public discourse, in his record as South Bend mayor. What did you conclude about where he stands in terms of policy?
So we factored in Pete Buttigieg's past. As you probably know, I've done a lot of reporting on Pete Buttigieg. Not much of it was positive, right? But and it surprised me when I looked specifically at what he called his Douglas plan for Black America. It was surprisingly detailed, and it showed a level of rigor and intense understanding of issues that face African American communities that was surprisingly deep. And it wasn't just wide, it was deep. And so, you know, objectively, I had to factor that in. You know, I also factored in his past and the complaints about, you know, from African-Americans in the city that he served. But looking at his agenda right? I had to give him credit that he at least had people who seemed to understand these issues and incorporated so many disparate ideas into his agenda. And then it was detailed. So, again, I was as surprised as you. But, you know, I had to give him credit.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Harriott. He's a writer based in Alabama, and he recently published an article in The Root that rates Democratic contenders for president with respect to issues of interest in the black community. You know, let's move on to talk about Bernie Sanders. We should definitely speak about his campaign's interactions with black voters. But first of all, how did you find what he had to offer in terms of policy?
You know, Bernie Sanders' plan is another one that surprised me because it had a surprising, a shocking lack of detail. Like his education plan was basically like, I am going to make sure discrimination ends. You know, and he didn't spell out specifically, especially when compared with people like Warren or Biden or even Buttigieg, how he planned to do this. You know, he would say, I'm going to increase Title I funding, which is the fund that goes to disproportionately poor and minority schools. He didn't say how much it was. He just said he was going to increase funding. And he didn't say how he was going to address these disparities. He just said, hey, you can be sure that I'll address these disparities. And then why it's problematic is because when you look at his Medicare for plan or Medicare for All plan, for instance, or his tax plan, they're surprisingly detailed. And it's like he did this plan for Black America, or he addressed Black issues performatively. And so we had to subtract from him for that. And I think it jibes with his overall tenor during this campaign, where he kinds of casts racial disparities as a simple problem of economics. And while race and economics are inextricably intertwined, I don't think they're the same thing, right? You have to be intentional about confronting racial disparities us outside of economics, because as we know, when the economy gets better, you know, every boat rises, but black people's still are below the level of white, you know, economic power and wealth and income. You know, we see the disparities all the time. And I think that Bernie Sanders' plan shows a lack of detail on how he specifically wants to fix and confront these problems.
If Bernie Sanders' policy proposals, and maybe we could say his worldview, if they are inclusive of black people but not for black people, is that necessarily a deal breaker?
I guess it depends on your perspective, right? If you're black, and it could be a deal breaker, right? If you've experienced extreme levels of inequality, or if you've seen it and have lived through it personally, then it might be a deal breaker. There are people, right, who are, for instance, black students who are suffering from overwhelming student debt, who love his plan to cancel debt. There are people who, you know, attend, you know, underfunded predominantly white colleges, who would love to see him erase income inequality. So I guess it depends on your lived experience and your perspective.
We were talking with a Democratic consultant from Michigan, Adrian Hemond, who was pointing out this fact that Senator Sanders has really had a huge year in Michigan in 2016, but has not picked up substantial support in African-American communities. Let's listen to this clip.
African-American voters in general, we have not been Senator Sanders' base of support. You know, he's done really, really well with Latino voters, and he's done really, really well with younger voters, but he's had some difficulty cracking into the black community in a significant way. I don't see much difference in that in the primary right now, I think, because they're pretty confident they can win Michigan without changing their strategy too much, and I think they're right about that. For the general election, it's going to need to be an area of focus. You know, Bernie talked about this a second ago, that, you know, the president won Michigan by about 10,000 votes in 2016. Coincidentally, turnout in the city of Detroit was down by about 10,000 votes in 2016.
Michael Harriott, I wonder if you agree with what was put out there, that there may be key states that Bernie Sanders might win, even if he doesn't change his campaign strategy with the black community in 2016.
It is a possibility, and the possibility isn't because of anything that Bernie has done right. It is because that black voters are keenly aware that they want to remove Trump out of office, right? So it's not like even in this election, in the primary election, it's not as much a referendum on which candidate is best for a lot of black voters. It is which candidate can beat Trump. Right. So that's the political calculus that a lot of black voters and a lot of voters, period, are making. Right. So there might be the chance that Bernie could succeed without winning the black vote in the primaries. But he's going to have to, in the general election, whoever the candidate is, find a way to motivate black voters to get out beyond just hating Trump.
As you look at the narrowing field and you think about how the front runners might be considering their choices for vice president, is there anyone out there who you think would make an intriguing choice, either people who were declared candidates in the presidential race and dropped out, or just other folks who are out there on the national scene that you think might bolster a front runner's case at this point?
So I think the most intriguing prospect for vice president is Stacey Abrams. I think you can look at how she increased turnout and participation in Georgia, which is a red state, and almost turned that state purple and almost won her candidate. Some people say, you know, if it wasn't for shenanigans, then she might have won. So the idea of turning Georgia blue is intriguing, not only because of the possibility of her being the first black female vice president, but because Georgia has an important Senate race. And so, you know, increased black voter turnout and increased participation could possibly change that Senate seat. And she's young. She has a bright political future. And I think everyone is kind of waiting to see what she's going to do. And so, you know, she would make the most intriguing choice. You look at Andrew Gillum in Florida. You know, whoever the candidate is, whoever the nominee is going to really need those delegates and those electoral votes out of Florida. And we saw how he overperformed in Florida in the 2018 midterm. So he makes an intriguing candidate. Kamala Harris, a senator, young, vibrant, skilled legislator. She makes an intriguing choice. There are quite a few viable and intriguing candidates for vice president.
Michael, maybe my political memory just isn't that long, but I feel like something has happened in the last couple of cycles where the white mainstream of the Democratic Party is just talking in maybe starting to have a different understanding about what the black vote means and about what it means to put forward a candidate that represents America and that appeals to America. I mean, these things can be cyclical, but do you think something different is happening this year?
I think the last election, the 2018 elections, taught them what happens when you just take the black vote for granted, when you just say, look, they turned out in 2008, they turned out in 2012, they'll turn out in 2016, right? They're going to vote Democratic. So, like, that's not who we need to focus on. I think, you know, the failure of that is how Trump got into the White House. And I think the other thing is the 2018 midterm showed the party what could happen if black voters are energized, right? And how that can reverberate throughout the ticket. Like when we talk about the 2020 elections, we usually focus on the presidential candidate. And the most important part of this is that they know, right? Like we know who most white voters are going to vote for. Most white voters are going to vote for Trump. So the only way to defeat them is with an energized and passionate base. And the base of the Democratic Party is black voters.
Michael Harriott, thank you so much for all the work you put into just this one article. And I'm looking forward to seeing the other stuff that you're working on for this year.
Well, cool.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about the impact of agriculture on Michigan's economy.
Agriculture is a vibrant part of the scene. It's just a relatively small part of the scene in dollar terms.
That's our show for today, though. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.